Welcome to Season 2, Episode 6 of the Coaching Badges Podcast, brought to you by our good friends at PlayerStat Data. Thanks for listening in. Joining me on the show tonight, my co-host Mark Anderson and regular contributors Paul, Willie and Mick. Great to have you on as always, lads. On the pod tonight, we chat about news from the sporting week gone by. We'll also be discussing our coaching topic for the show. This week, we're discussing the recent change in schoolboy football for under-13s to remain at 9v9. Later on, Mark O'Sullivan joins us as our guest. Mark currently works in Sweden with AIK Stockholm and once appeared on stage with Morten Harkett from AHA, but more on that later. Along with the other usual bits and pieces, we hope you'll enjoy the show. So, Mark, what have you got for us from the world of sport this week?
Well, I suppose it's a long time since we've seen a tournament again. I'm just so glad Ireland aren't there because, like, I mean, who wants to go and travel in these times? And we wouldn't have really enjoyed it anyway. But I got real FOMO actually tonight watching the opening ceremony from the Italy-Turkey game and also realising, Jesus, how important it is for kids, especially in the younger generations, to watch their country and their nation and their heroes that they look up to. In European football or international tournaments. And the fact that we're not there is just a huge missed opportunity that I think is something that we'll suffer for the next few years over. But anyway, looking forward to seeing that and some fans at it as well. So it should make for an interesting tournament. Other thing as well, just on that, I thought Gareth Southgate put together a really, really good article that he put out just talking about how he felt to be the manager and about his role. And he wrote an open letter. Very, very, very good. He's a manager I admire an awful lot, in that he's quite modern in how his approach is, how he deals with players. And he talks about his inclusion, how he talked about the players taking a knee. And that's kind of saying things like, well, if you don't understand why we take a knee, you don't understand the problem. Which I thought was quite a very good open letter. And given that English fans have recently, in their last two friendlies in Middlesbrough, booed their own team taking a knee. I just don't know. I just don't get it in my head. I just can't understand how these people operate. Whatever you feel, you don't have to express it like that. And then the last thing, the big thing I actually thought was Naomi Osaka, who the tennis player who pulled out of the French Open, citing anxiety for media interviews. And she got fined $15,000. And Serena Williams and a lot of other stars came out and actually sympathised with her. She suffers, she says, with nerves in front of the press. She's quite timid and in how she talks, and she doesn't enjoy that public part of the job, so to speak. But I just thought it's quite ironic. A young girl, obviously very successful, but mentions mental health challenges and mentions her anxiety, and she gets pillared by both some of the people in the press and her own organisation. She's also since pulled out of the tournament in Berlin, which is putting doubts over her playing in Wimbledon. But I just thought, again, another organisation that just pays lip service to the likes of mental health and challenges that and only when it suits them. And Serena Williams was very, very good, wrote a really nice article about how she'd love to give her a hug and put her arm around her, that she's been there, but she's built in a different kind of way, probably due to her background to deal with this kind of things, but that very unfair how she was treated. So it was quite an interesting take.
Yeah, thanks for that, Mark. Three good things there. Really looking forward to the Euros. It sounds crazy to say it's Euro 2020, but it's mad. So it's kicking off tonight, so I'm looking forward to seeing that. It'd be interesting to see. I'm really just looking forward from a coaching point of view to see, is there anything new tactically we can learn from it, or what way your team's going to set up in terms of what's kind of flavour of the month at the minute. So that's interesting. You mentioned Southgate. I like Southgate. I think he speaks well. He's articulate. And was it Roy Keane or somebody during the week said he's the perfect international manager? And he's suited for that role. And I thought he spoke very well about him, actually. And then finally, about that young tennis player, I totally agree with you. I think we pay lip service to far too much, and not just mental health issues. You know, it's easy to say you support X, Y, or Z, but the true proof of the pudding is, you know, your actions. And to find somebody who's suffering with anxiety or has stated that's the reason that they don't want to do interviews, seems remarkable in this day and age when there is such a light shining on mental health and mental health issues. So that they couldn't offer her support seems remarkable, regardless of what the sponsorship or contract obligations are. It just seems ridiculous. So yeah, good stuff, mate.
Just on that, can you imagine what she would have had to go through in her head even to come out and say some of the challenges she's faced, considering also knowing that she would and how she would be seen, and would it be seen as a sign of weakness, or how it would be picked up? So even having the bravery to come out and say why she didn't want to do it, but then to have our own organisation threaten to find her, expel her, and all of that, I just think it's horrendous.
It is, Matt. When we're doing so much, and not just us, people in general, to make people feel comfortable about speaking about how they feel and to talk up. And then when you do, you know, stick your head out and you say, right, I'm feeling this way, that people come down on you like that just seems ridiculous, in my opinion.
Who do you fancy to win the Euros?
Ooh, good question. I hope North Macedonia, considering the team that me and Willie got in the pool. But I don't think that's going to happen, Mick. So I'll settle for our second pick, Spain. I'll just stick with my old favourites. I love Spain. And I got them in the draw.
I can't see Spain getting, I think, France for me. It's just the squad they have.
Wait, I'll tell you. Italy. France or Germany not to get out of the group is 10 to 1. There's Germany, France, and Portugal in the group. Germany at the end of their tether, I think. Your man Yucky Bolt, he's leaving now after the Euros. I think they might struggle.
Yeah, that's it.
I fancy Portugal.
Portugal had a great squad. France, Portugal, Belgium, and England. The last four, I'd say.
Could England do it, lads?
No. I listened to Liam Brady on RTE earlier on, and he said he was just at the start of the previews tonight, and he said he spoke to Marco Tardelli, and he said they don't like that everything seems to be going right in their build-up, really good results. No disharmony, really good culture and really good fit. And he says, Marco Tardelli said, I don't like that. We need some mischief.
Chaos.
They normally get beaten in their first game, then going to win it. You know what I mean? Yeah, always.
Oh, it's crazy.
Any dark horses, do you think, like a Greece 2012?
I don't know. I think there's bigger nations are getting stronger already. The obvious ones, the Portugal, Spain, Germany's France. I think England do have a chance, but they always say this every year, but I don't think they'll go all the way. Definitely semi-finals.
Yeah. Tournament football is a strange thing because aside from how good you are as a player or a squad, that whole thing of being out of your environment, away from home, and some players struggle with that. And you know, some players thrive in it and some countries thrive in it. And it really is something that it's hard to describe when you have a group of players away for a length of time, how they gel or bond or don't. And how they perform, and so much of it is down to then just the confidence of your results, you know, from game to game, and how the media treat you. It's crazy.
Interesting one thing: fans are back in the stadium, right? But if you look at Hungary, there's 20 odd thousand or nearly full capacity are being allowed at their games, and then in the other ones, it's much much lower. So you wonder how that will affect some of the results.
How's that allowed?
They don't care.
They took the Russian vaccine.
Yeah,
they just
and a load of vodka.
That's not even a lie. They took the Russian one, Sputnik, and the Chinese one. That's why. I was reading that could
be a big factor in things as well. You just wouldn't know. And Belgium will be there.
England are playing Wembley for the first four games, aren't they?
That's got to help. Jesus.
No. Here, I thought the Chinese vaccine wasn't registered in Europe. I didn't think any country in Europe was allowed to use the Chinese vaccine. I thought I read that somewhere during the week. Obviously not then. That's weird, isn't it?
Well, if you're taking the Russian, you might as well take the Chinese, I suppose.
You can buy that Chinese one down in Ratnew.
They're growing it down there.
10 pack.
Oh, I love it. Right, lads, I'm moving away from COVID. So on now to our coaching topic, and every week on the pod we'll try and get into detail on some coaching aspect, just discuss the detail of it. This week it's an interesting one. It's about this year's move to keep the under-13s in the DDSL at 9-a-side, when traditionally they would have moved to 11-a-side at under-13. And I appreciate that this has probably come about because of COVID, but it's worth just having a chat about the merits of it, the pros and cons of doing it. So, lads, can I throw it open to you? Like, what are your own immediate thoughts on under-13s staying at 9-a-side, 9v9, rather than moving to 11v11?
Personally, myself, it's there's pros and cons. Ideally, In a perfect world, 9-a-side at 13s is a great idea. And I don't think players should move to 11-a-side until under 14. So that's just my personal opinion. 9-a-side, it's a small-sided game. Obviously, it gives players more touches. The DDSL felt they needed to do this year because they'd had players who would have been gone from 7-a-side straight into 11-a-side, which is crazy anyway. But the problem, my issue with it, although I support the small side of the game and I'm a huge advocate of it, and it's the size of the goals, it's just crazy. And the players are a year older and there's offside. So you've got smaller pitches now and bigger goals for bigger players. So while it's a great idea in theory, the logistics aren't there. The FAI don't have, the clubs don't have the proper gear. Like it's vital that the goals are the correct size. You know, like the normal 7-a-side goals, which are going to be used, are 12 by 6, I think. You know, so you're going to get a 13-year-old standing in them. So, I mean, that's really a downside to it. You know, that alone, the size of the goals. I'm all for the 9-a-side, but, I mean, it's got to be done right. It's got to be done right. And I don't know how it's going to go with the size of the goals and offside, and the players are a year older.
So, yeah, it's an interesting one. So just for clarity, right, because it's been a while since I was involved with those younger ages. So, and again, for any listeners who aren't from Ireland, DDSL is just one of the leagues in Ireland. So it's just one of the associations making the decision for their particular jurisdiction. But am I right in saying, Mick, that from around 8 and 9, is it 5-a-side?
Yes, I think so. And then 10 and 11 is
7-a-side. So they obviously use the 7-a-side goals.
Yes. Yeah.
And then traditionally have under 12s been 9-a-side using 7-a-side goals.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Ah, okay.
Now, it's you'd get away with it because the kids are a year younger. It's not ideal, but there should be 9-a-side goals.
Oh, completely.
To make these transitions from each game to make it more enjoyable, to have more goals for a start, and also to develop goalkeepers.
Yeah.
You know, to develop goalkeepers in an honest way. The goal size of the 9-a-side goals are 16 foot long by 7 foot high, you know. Right. That's the standard for 9-a-side. But I mean, there's no club in the country has 9-a-side goals as that I'm aware of. They're all using those 7-a-side goals, which are I think they're only just looking at it here 12 by 6.
Well, certainly if you were to put an under 13 into a 7-a-side goal, it'd be considerable difference, you know, than putting an under 13 into a full size goal. Can I also ask, because I'm unsure on this? So are they playing 9-a-side, so with 7-a-side goals, right, which is a problem in itself, but are they also still playing on a 7-a-side pitch, just putting extra players on it?
The pitches, there's no dedicated pitches. They kind of have to mark out the areas themselves. And generally, a lot of clubs are using 7-a-side pitches because traditionally they'd only had kind of one group playing 9-a-side. So if we're going to do these things, and I think it's a good move by the DDSL, but it's got to be done right. I mean, the dimensions of the pitches have to be right. The goal size have to be correct as well.
No, I totally agree with that. Like I've never been a fan of under 13s playing 11-a-side because they go onto the pitch and they're just lost on the pitch. No matter how good they are, physically they're not capable of running in the bigger areas. They're not capable of passing the ball over the distances. And sadly, because they're on a bigger pitch, a lot of young players seem to feel the need to kick the ball further away. It's like a psychological thing. They need to kick it further.
It's definitely anti-development. It is.
It is.
It's soul destroying for goalkeepers as well. I mean, goalkeepers should be in goals that are relative to their size as they get older.
Absolutely. And am I, again, I know this has come in because of the unprecedented stuff going on with COVID, where, you know, one particular age group almost lost out on a year of under nines. So that was part of the reason that I think it was put forward to give those kids a chance to play at least a year at under nine. But at 9-a-side, are they talking about this only being a one off? So could it be that they'll revert back to under 13, been 11-a-side in a year?
I don't know. That's the question.
Well, I think they should have at least 2 years at 9-a-side. Like 2 years at 5-a-side, 2 years at 7-a-side, 2 years at 9-a-side. Then at around 14, you're into 11-a-side. And then physically, you're more capable. And you've come up, if the pitches and net sizes are appropriate, you've come up having 2 years at each of the various 5, 7, and 9-a-side. That has to help your development.
Oh, I agree. And again, it's not just the size dimensions of the pitches and the goals. Smaller players tend to be neglected at under 13s because it's on an 11-a-side pitch. They're probably not as physically as strong. They probably can't kick the ball as far. They obviously haven't grown to the required height, if they're not required height, but they're not tall enough to be seen to be goalkeepers or going to be goalkeepers. So, I mean, it's a good move, as I said, but it has to be done right, and there should be. I would like this to stay as it is, to be honest with you. But with a massive investment for clubs to invest in the right equipment.
Mick, sorry, I was just going to ask you there. So the DDSL is doing that this year. What's all the rest of the leagues doing in the country at under 13? Are they still?
I honestly, I honestly don't know. Willie,
just on that, over the years, there's often been cases where certain leagues will adapt, say, a five-a-side approach at a certain age, and others will stay seven. And so there's always been variances. But obviously, there has to be some kind of alignment if the current National League structure stays in place, where you're looking to get kids in at under, well, I know it's 14s this year, but so if that goes back to 13s next year, will all of a sudden there be pressure to make the leagues 11 aside again? So, there has to be a certain amount of alignment. And yet, in saying that, over the years, there's often been times where different leagues adapt different approaches to the younger age groups in particular. So I think it would be good to have a more joined up approach, but it doesn't always happen.
Absolutely.
Yeah. No, I think Mick's right completely on that. There's no point in doing the nine aside if there's no proper equipment for it and pitch sizes and regulations. And then offside, it's going to be pretty hard for a referee to offside, to call offsides in such a tight space with players. The fine margins, the ball would be going quicker from one end of the pitch to the other, you'd imagine, on a smaller pitch.
It's not too bad, Paul, when some clubs are lucky enough to have an area that's a little bit bigger than a seven-a-side. But you go to some clubs around Dublin and they just don't have the space. And they're using a pitch that's used for a seven-a-side. There's been a seven-a-side game on before and it's too tight.
Yeah. So is every week they possibly been playing on a bigger pitch and bigger goals every week? Could they be changing? Some clubs might have the facilities, some won't.
Yeah, but I mean, with money, if you'd won an 11-a-side pitch, it can be adapted to a 9-a-side pitch temporarily with those white line markers that the professional clubs have. You just mark out the area and carry the goals on and carry the goals off. But yeah. I think the goals are the crucial thing. The football's about goals, let's be honest about it. And I don't think you're going to see a lot of goals in the 9-a-side at under 13s, basically because of the size of the players.
Well, that might be a bad thing as well. You might have to improvise a lot more now and probably move it quicker.
Yeah,
I remember when we were all playing, we played on full-size pitches at 9, 10 years of age, and the big lad in the midfield was scoring from the halfway line against a small keeper.
Yeah, I mean, but just because we did those things, Paul, doesn't make it right.
I'm saying that's completely wrong. What have we done?
Absolutely. And I remember at under 11s, and this is back in the 70s, playing on 11-a-side pitch with a size 5 ball.
Size 5, yeah. I was about to say. There's weighted footballs in now, Mick.
When that ball came down out of the air, you didn't want to hit it.
Yeah. I did.
And that's what happened to you guys.
It's interesting. I was doing some Googling when I knew we were going to be talking about this, and I was saying last year there was actually the FAI did, or the FAI in the England, did held a webinar and had a seminar on around, and one of the former coaches at Brighton put up a stat that 9v9 versus 11v11, there was 135% more passes, 260% more shots, 500% more goals, 225% more 1v1 instances, and 280% more dribbles. Those figures alone should be the reason.
Absolutely. Yes. I tell you, that's brilliant, Mark. And I love when you can back anything up with some kind of evidence rather than it just being, this is what happened. But I had to go back to everyone's technique to the point about the goals. Is a little bit of it just that I hear the pitch is set up. I'm not looking out extra goals, and because it's hard enough to get people to put up the actual goals for any game at junior level. You're always roping in parents and you're roping in people to help. Is there an element of it just we'll set up one pitch and that'll do?
I don't agree with that, Gab. I think the clubs don't have goalposts are expensive. They really are. They're an expensive item, and 9-a-side goals are hard to get. And I have to be honest with you, I haven't seen a set of 9-a-side goals.
I don't think I've ever seen a set of 9-a-side goals in a club.
I have when we visited the UK academies or in Spain or wherever we've been, Portugal, any of those academies, they would have had 9-a-side goals or 8-a-side goals as they call them. Some countries play 8-a-side.
But if I totally agree with you, by the way, but if it's so important to the development of the kids and it's been proven, as Mark has just said, in terms of the statistics that back it up, should it not be a thing then that from the NGBs down and the various countries that there is funding for 5-a-side goals and 7-a-side goals and 9-a-side goals, and you do it properly. You use the appropriate equipment with the appropriate balls, whether that's, and there's arguments for using weighted footballs or different size footballs, I get that. But ultimately, you're trying to create the right environment for the players at the right time so that they experience the game at the appropriate level to the to their ability, one, but to the progression of where they're at physically and mentally. And that doesn't happen. That doesn't happen.
I love that stat on the 1v1s. I mean, surely, like, when we talk about, we always talk about the old style street footballer and actually taking on and beating a player. Like, I mean, I love that stat that they put up about how many 280% more 1v1s. Like, that's just incredible in a game. Can you imagine how better, how technically better players could be in that exposed more of those situations?
Yeah, completely. You've got me thinking there, Mark, about, so if you take, to Mick's example earlier, you have a seven-a-side pitch with a seven-a-side goal, but essentially you're shoehorning in a nine-a-side game onto it. Does that affect the formation that you're trying to develop? You know, with the players being that much more condensed, and does it alter the way your team sets up, or should that even come into it?
Yeah, I think it does, but don't miss the point here. The nine-a-side is, as I think we're all in favour of it, but the issue here this time around is that the players are actually a year older than they traditionally have been, which again, a good thing. But the pitches are going to remain the same size. They're a little too small in my opinion. And again, I go back to the goals. It's got to be done right. I can't understand why. I mean, there's no joined up thinking here. One league is doing it. It's probably the right thing. They're getting a lot of stick for it because it's not going to be done right. But it is a step in the right direction. And
I think it'll be a great step in the right direction, Mick, if they keep it. Yeah. You know I mean, so if this time next year we're rolling around and we're saying, right, it's worked out really well and the feedback's been good, and it's staying nine aside at under 13. Now, that obviously could potentially have a knock-on effect on the National League, who next year, none of us know, but could potentially be dropping, changing back to under 13, 11 aside.
They will. They'll go back to under 13. This is doctor's plan, and it's not going to change until he goes under 13, at 11 aside under 13. I don't know how anyone who's been involved in the game can actually advocate that it's good for kids that age. I really don't. And you'll get idiots on Twitter and you get idiots on social media, and that's all they are. If you honestly think that a 11-a-side game for an under 13, a 12-year-old player who can't even get the ball from a corner in a corner kick to the edge of the box,
it's crazy.
If you think that's good for development of players, you're a fucking gobshite. Sorry, excuse the language.
I'll have to get a beep button.
Tell me this, like, what do they do in the UK? When did they start 11-a-side in the UK? Does anyone know?
I don't know. I mean, and I hear so many different things. It could be the same. But why do we always wonder why they're doing in different countries? We're copying the Dutch methods here, and it's not working, in my opinion. But why can't we come up with a plan for Irish football?
Yeah, look, I'm in agreement with that. I've been involved throughout the years coaching at all different levels, literally from under fives up to seniors. And I always struggled with the first year that kids were going onto the big pitch, and not struggle coaching it. That's easy to do. It struggled watching it, seeing the kids struggling themselves physically and mentally with this. All of a sudden, it's like they're a fish out of water, and it's a massive jump. And to your point, Mick, to go, whatever about having your 2 years at five aside, 2 years at seven aside, you only get 1 year at nine aside traditionally. And they need another year at that. To me, it's a year of development lost throwing them in at 11-a-side too young. But again, look, it boils down to lots of different factors. The goals, definitely, and I get the finance piece. They are expensive. But if you're going to do it properly, then do it properly. Go and get the money and do it. People get the money for 7-a-side goals and they get the money for 11-a-side goals. So you just make 9-a-side goals part of your budget plan. You have to get them. But look, it's an interesting one. I'm going to look forward to trying to catch some under 13 games this year, and to see the nine-a-side and see how it actually looks, and see, are any clubs trying to make an effort to provide a nine-a-side pitch, you know? But it's an interesting one. I think it's going to rumble on, though, lads. I don't think it's going to be fixed this year. I think there'll be pros and cons when people review the year, and there'll always be the guys, Mick, as you said, who'll chip in and go, I would just go straight back to 11-a-side because that's what they're doing in the National League or in the UK or wherever else. But I'd be also interested to hear the arguments for people who advocate staying at 9v9. Up until an older age, you know, potentially 13.
Yeah, but like Mick says, it'll be easy for him to go back to 11v11 because if it's not set up properly, it's easy for him to say it's not working, so we just go 11v11.
But that's the problem, Will. Yeah, you're dead right.
because the pitch size isn't right and the goals aren't right.
Annie is like, you have Mick, I know. Will, have you ever coached like, you know, the under 13s going into
Are you mad?
Never.
I tell you, it's very, very difficult. It's very, because your expectation once you start to coach in a big pitch is obviously tempered by your experience with older players. And these kids at that age are a million miles away from what the older players can do. So you've got to really change almost everything in terms of your approach, the distances they can run, the distances they can pass, the space between them. They're just whole spatial awareness of the big space around them they struggle with. And you're dead right, Mick. The ones I feel the most sorry for are the young keepers in the big goals for the first time. They're lost.
Absolutely. I was just before I came onto this, I was coaching a nine-a-side team down in the club, and this is the first year. And immediately the coaches were I was trying to do the right thing, trying to play out, defenders high and wide, you know, creating space to play out. And immediately there's a problem, because the goalkeeper, who is your first player, is your first attacker, he's setting the tempo, he's setting the way you're going to play. He's not able to kick the ball so far. So you've got to adjust that. You've got to adjust that. And now, lucky enough, on the pitch that we had, it's basically is a nine-a-side pitch. It's a very large seven-a-side pitch. You could adjust it to do that, you know. But in the 11-a-side game, it's very difficult. And I think keepers who aren't strong enough yet to be able to play the ball the 15, 20 yards required are being overlooked. Oh, his distribution isn't good. Well, his distribution would be good if the pitch size was to properly.
And to put that in perspective, that means that a kid at that age may struggle to kick the ball out of their own box on a big pitch, which seems crazy.
Yeah. I know that the way the rule has changed, the defenders can come into the box, and that's great. I welcome that rule change, but we're still getting that if teams are going to be pressed, which a lot of them are now, if the keeper can't kick it over his first line, is basically his two centre halves to one of the fullbacks who are wide. His distribution's poor. You know, he's not great. You know, so it's discriminating against young players who could really end up being really good goalkeepers.
But imagine, like, we're expecting 11-year-olds, or we were expecting 11 and 12-year-olds to play on the same pitch and size and dimensions and goals as a 26-year-old, and a 10-year-old is not half a 20-year-old. So like, I mean, it's insane actually when you break it down to think that like a 10-year-old or someone playing on 11-a-side, it has the same capabilities as an adult or a 19-year-old to play in those sizes and those dimensions. It's just ridiculous.
It's a great point. It's like asking an 11-year-old, 12-year-old to go and play in a full-size snooker table, or to go and play on the same golf course that Tiger Woods plays on. You know what I mean? Like, it's just mental. So look, lads, I think we're not going to fix it here. And there are pros and cons. Don't get me wrong. It's not all bad. But I personally haven't seen and worked with younger players over the years, think that, you know, sometimes we're in far too much of a rush to get them into the 11-a-side game when they have so much to learn just about the basics of the game before we get there. So I would encourage, you know, lots of years of 5-a-side, 7-a-side, 9-a-side for as long as they can with good coaching. And that will ultimately help the development to kind of progress into the bigger game as such. But I watched that one with interest.
Maybe that's why we're so far behind technically, guys.
Willie, 100%. That's another day's talk, most certainly. Because again, without labouring the point, when you push kids onto the big pitch, big areas, big numbers, you get limited touches. You get all of a sudden bad decisions because they just feel naturally the pitch is so big, they have to get the ball down the far end as quick as possible. So the quickest way to do that, boot it long.
The physically stronger players and the bigger players and the born early players generally tend to...
They dominate.
Dominate, you know, and...
It's a good point. And the gas thing is, right, you know, guys, from working as we've done over the years together, as are moving along dealing with older players into senior players, a lot of the work we're doing is narrowing down the space, putting them under more pressure, encouraging more touches, making them make quicker decisions. So we're going the opposite way, and we're tightening and tightening and tightening the areas all the time to achieve what we want to achieve. So, and yet we're doing it our ways in the development of the younger players. We're getting them out into bigger and bigger and bigger areas quicker. It just defies logic to me.
Very well put, Gav.
On to our guest of the week, sponsored by PlayerStat Data. Every episode, we try to bring guests on to offer different perspectives on the world of sport and coaching. And this week, we're delighted to have Mark O'Sullivan on as our guest. Mark is currently the head of youth development for the ages 8 to 12 at AIK Stockholm in Sweden. He's also a UEFA A license holder and coaching consultant. Mark also educates and mentors the older age group coaches at AIK. He's a PhD research student and set up the R&D department at AIK Stockholm. He's published many articles on player development, pedagogy and learning. He helped the Canadian Soccer Association build out their new coach ed curriculum that was launched in 2019. Most importantly, he's a good Cork man like myself, and we're delighted that he joins us now. You're very welcome to the pod, Mark.
Thanks very much. Really honored and happy to be here. I think it's probably my first Irish pod.
Fantastic. Wow. Ah, I like that.
The first
like
Irish that. Cap. There well, you go.
First, you're our first ever guest from Stockholm, Sweden. So there's a load of firsts going on tonight. Look, Mark, before we get into our chat, you might just give our listeners kind of the summary version of your own sporting or working career to date.
All right. Well, I was born at a very young age. And my family background is really a lot in music and sport. You know, we all played sport, we all watched sport, and we all played musical instruments. So that was quite cool, I think. And that's something that stayed with me through my life. And these things have ran parallel and still do to this day, even to this day. So I played schoolboy soccer in Ireland. I actually played a few games League of Ireland before I started university, but we'll get back. We might get into that later. I have a little anecdote later that'll be a bit of fun.
Lovely.
Then I started in university and I played the Munster Senior League, and I played Gaelic football and all other sports, but I also collected vinyl and music and learned to play guitar. And then in 94, I went to Stockholm to visit friends I studied with in university, and I was there for supposed to be there for 3 weeks, and I'm still here. So it just went on. And so it's like, you know, like it's funny, like one day I'm walking down the street and I bumped the guy called Murphy McCarthy. He's the drummer in the Sultans of Ping. If you remember him.
Wow, I do indeed, yeah.
So him, me, and another few people, and a few English guys and Dutch guys, we started a soccer club, really, you know, cool. And I was working in music as well. And then there was a soccer club, and the club actually did well. We got up to the third division in Sweden. And then, but still music was always there. I ran studios, I ran record labels, I DJed, I produced, I played everywhere, like playing in Tokyo, Montreal, got to travel a lot. It was phenomenal traveling around the world with that. But soccer was always in there somewhere, sport, but we'll say soccer mainly. And I think it was in the early 2000s, somebody asked me, would I help out coaching a local team, 16-year-olds? And I said, yeah. And then 2 weeks later, your man jumped off and I left on my own. So I said, geez, I better have some idea what I'm doing. And it's funny, like still the ideas I had then and all the differences now, I'm able to articulate those ideas much better, if you know what I mean. I ended up falling backwards into research. That was really just a complete accident. But it was also the curiosity, because when somebody says to me, those big words, they're nothing to do with football. And I just go, why? Why don't you have anything to do with football? Mm-hmm. And I never liked this, particularly like, you know, when you come from a culture that, let's say, historically has a lot of its right to its own education being denied, that I think it's really good. I take great pride in actually going on this journey, even though it's quite academic and learning. Brilliant. And it's absolutely
brilliant.
Been phenomenal learning and humbling journey for me. And to be able to help articulate how you think. And once you go further into it, the language then gets simpler because you express yourself in a simpler way.
Well,
so that's kind of it. It's basically music, football, and now academia as well. And I think the actual last gig, proper gig I played was headlining Roskilde Dance Tent in 2006 in Denmark at the festival. And I was on stage and I remember wondering, had I booked time in the washroom? 5,000 people there going nuts. So
yeah.
And that was kind of when I realized that maybe. And then this is true. This is known, like, I'm not making this up. I was on Argentinian TV at the festival And they asked me, says, so tell me about the gig tonight. And I says, no, you tell me why Peckerman took Riquelme off with 20 minutes to go against Germany when you're winning 1-0 and you freed Balak up, who ran the show and you lost. That's why. So that's better when I said, I guess this is taking over. So, yeah.
Already, this might have to be a two-part podcast.
The Riquelme years.
Yeah, I'm going to be honest. That's probably the best anecdote I've heard in all of it.
That's,
so far.
I think that's the best intro, the best summary of anybody we've got on the show so far. So I love it. And there's so much there we want to dig into, right? But you mentioned research, and I'm interested in that. So you were recently published in the International Journal of Sports, Science and Coaching, which is in itself is fantastic. But you might talk to us about the research you did towards contemporary players' learning and development, you know, the framework for sports practitioners, if you may. Okay. Well,
there's been a few articles published that we've published around this. So I need to go back to our club, AIK, to start this, if you don't mind. This. In 2017, AIK decided that they would remove its early selection model the same month it sold a player for €10 million to Dortmund, a 17-year-old, who now plays in Real Sociedad, Alexander Isak. Now, they removed the early selection model because they based a strategy on based their youth development on three simple strategies. One, well-being of children. Two, follow the United Nations Convention Rights of Children and have more players playing in their under 16, under 17s, under 19s and our respective senior teams. Because AIK is like, we have 11 sports in the club, but our senior men's team play in the National Stadium.
Right.
And, you know, an average crowd would be 35,000 or something. But the women's team also, now they've gone up to the top league as well, so they'll be playing there as well. So we built a research and development department, and I started a PhD around the same time. I was offered a PhD. I was writing this blog for years, just, you know, typical Irish streams of consciousness, you know?
Yeah.
Me trying my best to be sports answers to Flann O'Brien, I guess, but... it was actually Keith Davids, who was probably a hero of mine within the theory that I like. He said, would you be interested in doing a PhD? And I'm like, well, yeah, sure. I've even done a master's, but and it was phenomenal. It's been, and I'm doing it part-time, and it's been a phenomenal learning journey for me. So anyway, within this, we started. The first thing we decided to do was that, okay, we're making these changes, and the research and development department have to build a player development framework. So we decided that the best thing to do is you can't copy and paste from somewhere else. We're going to do our own research our own environment. How and why do coaches act this way? Why do people think this way? How can we connect what players do on the pitch to the socio-cultural context and even the culturally resilient beliefs around what learning is? So we investigate our own environment. And from this, we drew some ideas of why people behave in a certain ways. And a lot of it is into probably that there's a very linear understanding of human development. There's a very linear understanding of human development in coach education. And then, of course, we have these generic linear pathways that, you know, we're selecting kids at 7 and the best with the best and all these ideas. So most pathways in soccer are quite generic and linear. And when you really can't predict the future, we need to be more humble, I think, around this, because human development and learning is so non-linear. So anyway, part of this research was this paper. It's called Towards a Contemporary Player Learning and Development Framework. And the idea of it is to support coaches and clubs in understanding the non-linearity of human development, how you can design practice for this, and how you can understand, like, how individuals interact with their environment. And a simple thing would be, like, instead of saying learning and development, we say learning in development, meaning that learning happens in development. And these development changes can be, you know, you see kids at 8, like, you know, they might be the smallest, and then at 10, they're the tallest in their group, you know, or muscle changes. Then there's changes in family, you know, there's a separation going on. That's a change. Then there's changes in the social, in the culture in the area. And then there's COVID. That's another change. And it's how you act on these changes. That's what that's what learning is. So learning happens in all these development changes, and it's quite complex. So what we did, so this is how we're trying to help our coaches, and a lot of them are parent coaches. So we try to help them understand that learning and development is a very non-linear process. So this understanding of learning happens in development helps them. And then we gave a three-phase framework for coaches and players to work with. And that's a simple idea of co-designing. And that means really first for us, it means that a coach designs a training session, but it's how the players act on information in that training. It's their behavior that the coaches further develops the training session. Because the first feedback comes from the design to the players, how the players behave. Then the coach should be, through observing, should be understanding, okay, they're doing this, this is happening here, okay, they didn't see this gap, et cetera. And that's how they adapt their training sessions around that, from what the players are actually doing. And then we presented a very, very simple foundations for task design model to help particularly parent coaches on design football-specific training designs, and that is ball, opponents, direction, meaning you're going somewhere.
Yeah.
And consequence, if you lose the ball, the opponents can do something with it. And representative information. And we talk about this in the paper that you can have a game 4v4, and the classic one I hear is everyone must touch the ball before a goal is scored. Yeah, you have a ball, you have direction, you have consequence, but you've no the information is not representative. Because all you have to do is just everyone gather around one player and you've already solved the game then, because he can't touch the ball. So ball, opponents, direction, consequence, representative information. So we're trying to encourage coaches to design around that so that players are acting on information that is representative of the game, and it's how they act on that that the coach works around.
Brilliant.
And this challenges a lot of traditional coaching, coach education, where you have the class, and I've worked at this with the FA here, where you have a theme is given already, which is we're going to work on passing. Great, we've given away the answer. Then the coach will have his coaching points. And what do coaches do? They go out and look for their coaching points in the training session, not what the players are actually doing. And then you have a set routine of 10 minutes of this, 15 minutes of that, 20 minutes of that. But what happens if there's some really cool learning and going on? What happens if there's some cool interactions between players here? It's 15 minutes, we must stop and move on to the next thing. So we're challenging a lot of these linear approaches to coach education and these linear approaches to learning that still are alive in most coach education curriculums. So that's basically an example.
It's an incredible concept. It's amazing. And I mean, from a very lay point of view, I'm thinking about, okay, is that what we talk about when we talk about overcoaching? And your way is maybe to go back to those street footballers solving problems themselves and not always giving them the answer.
Yeah, exactly. But and another important thing here is that so you hear in a lot of coach education courses, like that if the player you ask a question and the player answers, oh, that doesn't mean they've learned it. That's knowledge about the game, understanding knowledge about the game. That's not knowledge in the game. It's the actual actions and behaviors they do in the game. That is what shows they understand and they're acting on information. Just because a kid can answer a question about that a coach answers does not mean they can do it.
No, that's a great point, because the kids are clever and they learn the coaching buzzwords very quickly, and they just regurgitate the buzzwords back, and people assume they know what's been asked of them. That's a very good point. Very good point. Oh man, it's you could talk about that forever.
I do.
it's fascinating. It's what, as I said to you earlier on, following you on social media, it's what always attracted me is how you spoke and about how you explained the game. But one thing that really fascinates me is that you've been in Sweden there for 25 plus years. Culturally, that's obviously very different to Ireland, but how does that reflect in the football industry? And even what you were answering there in your question earlier on, having that brave, is it a brave style culture that goes and challenges what you've always done? Or is that just... Is the culture quite brave over there to try new things? Or is it that just that's specific to AIK?
Well, I think overall the culture, I find the culture in football is very slow to adapt in most countries anyway, I think. I think sports like rugby and things probably tactically and training-wise are far more innovative from what I've seen. And I've worked with other people in other sports. Soccer tends to hang on to a lot of fads I think, you know, you see these gimmicks with flashing lights, and we're going to improve children's decision-making, and the ball comes to you and you play the ball to where a light flashes. I still have no idea when that happens on a pitch. In fact, if you're playing in the Bernabeu Stadium, you probably are the new camp, you probably want to avoid flashing lights because it's probably tourists. So, like, so we really are like football. So, but the culture in Sweden, yeah, one thing is that how sport is organized here. We have this governing body called Riksidrottsförbundet, which is the Swedish Sporting Confederation. And they get money from the government that they distribute to all the federations, like the Swedish FA, the Ice Hockey Association. And that money then goes out to clubs. So you would, for every kid that turns up at training, you get it, there's a tiny amount of money goes to that. Now, I think this is quite smart if you think about it. Now we're talking minimum. But it builds up. So like in AIK, we've 1,600 kids. So if you look, if you think about that, that builds up a lot of money, but it also saves money in heart monitors for 50 years later.
Yeah.
You know, so there is, and it also means that you can add an extra bit of money so the volunteer coaches can get some small bit of financial support in some way, or we can hire coaches. So that is a very good system. So in a way, there is government funding for every child that attends sessions and training and matches. That's a very positive thing, I think. It also, coach education is very affordable here. If you're a coach now at my club, you can do all your licenses paid for.
Wow. Well,
you don't pay a penny.
But that's investing in the future of the development of the coaches and the players, and like that.
I've never paid for a coaching license to do a course. I'm a UEFA course. I've never paid for it.
Fantastic. And funny, we talked to lots of people on the show, and funding and resourcing comes up again and again as a barrier to progression and development. It has to be addressed better. Now, that's really good to hear.
You know what? If you don't address it now, it becomes a massive socioeconomic issue in the future, where certain people from certain backgrounds will be the only ones able to afford these things.
I think that's an incredible point, and I think it's something that we discuss among us as coach. And now, Mick Brown, as an example, has a real fear that people who were coaching that who are just not going to go back and do that anymore, because financially it's just they can't afford it. The amount of time they give it up and the love of their game is just being squeezed out of them, and we're going to lose such a depth of knowledge.
Every single volunteer who gives their time to children should be getting decent education, because it's a huge responsibility, and they should be getting it free.
Yeah, I totally agree.
I tell you use the word responsible there, and it's brilliant, because it reminds me of the interview I read that you gave to the Examiner. There was a quote in it, and I'm not sure if it was your quote, but the quote in the article was that children and young people who devote themselves heart and soul to football deserve responsible and knowledgeable leaders. Now that's a powerful statement.
From Urban Hammer, the head of coach education, Swedish FA. So in 2014, even though Sweden for many years had a very traditional coach education system, I went through with it. It was good, but it wasn't that great. But now, in fairness, they've done a lot of work in changing. In 2014, they began changing it. But the first book you open up in the C, I have the book there, in the C license, which is the first children's license. First page is United Nations Convention on Rights of Children.
Brilliant.
And you know, they're basing on basically the head articles of Article 2, Article 3, 6, and 12 are very much define how we work with kids and coach education, etc. in Sweden. And that is the aim. Again, and that is, like as I said, AIK, the club, we're a professional club. We play in the national stadium. We have academies. We have a massive responsibility. But our aim is well-being of children, follow the United Nations Convention on Rights of Children, and more players playing at under 16, under 17, under 19, and in our senior teams. But again, and this kind of is captured in Urban Hammer's quote there, which is they need it. And that is why you need to make it affordable, because you need to have knowledgeable leaders. If your son has gone out to the local club with a coach, a parent, it's good if they have some understanding of children's development, of learning, a few ideas about designing training, and a few ideas about that. You know, because, you know, you have the usual. I even hear it on the media here now. We lose, Ireland lose a game to Luxembourg, and there's lads talking about we need to get the best six-year-olds of the best six-year-olds of the best coaches. That is just horrendous stuff to be hearing on radio. You know, that's just like crap. What we need is we need more qualified leaders and coaches working with our children.
That's not rocket science at times, is it? It's not rocket science, but as a country, we're incredibly good at actually making simple things very, very complicated.
You mentioned something earlier, Mark, just before we came on the pod, and it was about language. And you might just give us a little bit of thought about that, because I think it ties in very well with that whole piece about leadership. You know, the importance of the right language with people who are knowledgeable and who are charged to lead our children. You might just give us your thoughts on language, because I know.
I'll give you a few simple examples. So my one thing that I stand for is language precedes culture.
Right.
How we talk to each other. You want to change culture, change how people talk to each other. Change the language. So I'm listening after the Luxembourg game. All I'm hearing is we need to get elite eight-year-olds products. Children are now products, apparently. We're producing them in academies.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like some sort of tailoristic industrial revolution conveyor belt that we're supposed to be doing. Like, these are human beings. These are complex lives, you know. This is, you know. But so the word elite comes up, the word product. So conveyor belt, football belt. Football factory. So what we're looking at here is in our work is that when we started this in 2017, the first thing we realized was that we had to go through all our own literature in the club and go, what words can be problematic? Elite, nice. Remove it. Product, remove it. So words like that. So we have to be very clear when we're out speaking with parents, with coaches, with kids, that we don't use these words. But then the words don't become used in the culture. So when the parents talk to you, they don't use those words either. Now, I did some work in 2017 into 18. I still do a bit with the Canadian Soccer Association. I helped them build their new coach education curriculum for children. And it was really cool. Jason DeVos, he played with Wigan and he played with Ipswich. He was a Canadian captain. He contacted me when he got the job of head of development there. So he sent me their stuff. And he said, can you just look at this? So, and I looked at it and I said, okay, Jason, you need to call me. He says, what? We need to change one word in everything here. Mm. I said, what's that? We need to change the word teaching to learning. He says, why? And I said, because you're not America. You're influenced by this myth of the Hollywood coach that comes from America, where there's the halftime speech that changes everything. Yeah. You know, the coach that gives halftime speech changes the whole thing and he gets lifted off the pitch at the end and gets the girl. You know? So that's what you're doing. So you have kids. So you're talking about teaching kids. No. Let's see what happens if we say we only speak about learning. So I was over working with all the technical directors there for 5 days, and Jason was brilliant. The word learning was only to be used instead of teaching. He says, we're going to switch it. So we actually constrained. It's like what we call a constraints-led approach to how we interacted with each other. And so we spoke. They weren't allowed teaching. They were supposed to speak about learning. Totally changed the conversation. Totally changed the perspective. Because that's what coaches need. They need to understand, what is learning? How do humans learn? And is it just because you're brilliant at six, or you're brilliant at seven, or you're brilliant at eight? And how do I help this person learn? And what is the rate limiter? What's stopping this person from learning these things at the moment? Is there other things? So that's where the conversations went. So this is what I mean. You want to change your culture, change your language, change how people talk to each other.
Brilliant.
Brilliant. Love that. Absolutely.
I really like that. Yeah.
I can relate. Actually, it's funny. I every time I go away, I go to the States quite often on holidays, and I always manage to find a park where there's a couple of games going on. And I am absolutely horrified. Absolutely horrified of not everybody, but the vast majority of coaches that I've seen and their language and how they behave on the sidelines at an under 10 or 11 or 12 game. And it's like watching that that movie that Al Pacino's in.
Yeah, that's it.
Speech. And like, you're sitting there and the kids are staring, just aghast. They don't even know what's going on. And I'm just, I'd be horrified. I watched that Last Chance You on Netflix as well.
Yeah.
And you see the coach throwing things around. And I'm just going, in the name of God, can you? I mean, why would you even send your child there? Well, I spoke to a couple of parents over there, and I find it, that's why I find it really interesting what you say about language. I'm saying, why do you say, oh, well, he's the best coach because he wins things? I said, yeah, you must be doing that well because your kid won't be playing football in 5 years' time. There's no,
way. And the thing is, what's driving this, and I feel sorry for these coaches because they're just part of a system that's been driven by a market.
Yeah.
Not driven by learning. The market is driving all this. And that's also an issue we're dealing with here in Sweden. It's becoming, of course, like it's a professional sport. It's the adultification of children's sport that's becoming market driven. And this is happening in many places around the world. And I feel sorry for those coaches because they're just responding to the market.
Yeah. No, it's interesting stuff.
I'm going to switch over there for a little bit there to something different. I mean, I can confess I know absolutely nothing about ice hockey except that it seems very fast and very slippy. And there's no way I would survive anywhere near that. But I've seen from your research that you did an interview with him, and I hope I pronounced the man's name, Pavel, the magic man, Datsuk, for your
Datsuk.
That's really interesting that you go. I mean, I always love to see coaches going outside of their own sport to find some knowledge. What did you learn, or what was the biggest learning that you took from?
Okay, there's a little story about it. So I was asked to speak at the World Ice Hockey Conference in Toronto in 2018, I think, is it? Or 19. Yeah, 2019, I think, summer 2019. Yeah, and I've had a lot of contact with just through coaching and through, like, I've no idea of ice hockey, but still, you know, it's like it's an invasion sport. It's very skillful, and a lot of the principles in soccer, like is in Gaelic and hurling and ice hockey, they're quite similar principles, you know, attacking space and defending space, attacking gaps and defending gaps, and there's transition. So I had a lot of contact with a coach who was the Detroit Red Wings coach, and he also was assistant coach in the Swedish national team, even though he's American. So, and he told me about Pavel, and he said to me, Mark, like this guy Pavel, we call him the magic man. We've never seen skills like this at all, ever. And you know that he uses the least amount of sticks in the NHL. And like, it's just phenomenal. So, and he kind of showed, he said he was good friends with Pavel, so he called him when I was over there. And Pavel gave a little brief background of his, you know, so I wanted to know more. So I got in touch with a friend of mine who works in a university in Finland, who's Russian. So we did an interview. We had to do it in Russian because I wanted to get his exact meaning. So I didn't really take part that much in the interview because my Russian is not really up to date. So I can't even play a balalaika. So
I can't even pronounce it. So you're all right.
So it was really fascinating. So Pavel said that because of the socioeconomic situation growing up in his part of the Soviet Union at the time, if you broke his ice hockey stick, as say, as a 9 and 10 year old, he might be waiting a few weeks or a month or two before he gets a new one. So he learned to play ice hockey protecting the stick and the puck. Wow. So he developed this really unorthodox style. But he said what was lucky is the coaches also were very like creating problems in small games for them on the hockey rinks. So he was developing his style in very information-rich situations. And he turns up then in the NHL. He gets drafted very late because he's so unorthodox. And nobody can read how he plays. And it's like people are bamboozled. And he's in the Ice Hockey Hall of Fame now and regarded as one of the most innovative hockey players. And he still uses the least, and well, at that time when he was playing there, he used the least amount of sticks in the NHL. And I said to him, we asked him about a slap shot, which is a very way of just hitting it. He says, I don't know how to do that.
Yes.
In fact, I was scared because I might break it. So there's certain things you get, techniques you get taught in ice hockey school. He says, I can't do that. He says, but it was just, he's such an unorthodox style. And it's funny, then when I was over there in America, of course, there's these one-on-one snake oil guru coaches going, learn to play like Pavel. Yeah, we'll go to Russia, be poor. You know, if you break your stick, you don't play for 3 weeks.
Jeez, I tell you.
It's a bit like those downloads, amazing, isn't it?
Play like Barcelona.
Plays like Barcelona. After every European Championship, World Cup, it's learn to play the Croatia way. Six downloads.
But isn't this interesting from an Irish perspective? When you consider the sports and the opportunities children in Ireland could have. Now, we should not force children to play multi-sports. We should create opportunities for them, and we should never deny it.
Yeah, I like that. See, that's a different language.
Yeah,
definitely.
That's what I mean. I'm so hung up on language and about how we communicate with kids.
And
Gavin will tell you, even there, Bob, I never talk about results or I never talk about outcome. It should be the process to get you there. But yeah. I love the fact that what you just said there about we're not telling you that you can't do it, but you should be encouraged.
Yeah, you should be encouraged. The opportunity should be there to play other sports. Yeah. And we should not deny it because our under-13s might win the championship this year or the Munster title. Yeah. And the thing is, I really think that Ireland has an incredible opportunity for young people to develop really unique skill sets in whatever sport because of the opportunities to play hurling, soccer, rugby, Gaelic. There's massive opportunities there.
Great point.
And you know when I realised this? I was doing my UEFA B over here and they had a goalkeeping. They had an international goalkeeper coach come in and they were going to do distribution from the goalkeeper's hand. And he turns to me, have you played in goal, Mark? I went, never. So he says, Grant, we're going to work with distribution. And he was going to correct all my technique, which is just nonsense as well. So I was kicking the ball from the hand. He was looking at me, have you not played in goal? I was, no, never. So I was kicking, side volleying, drop kicking. Then I was switching feet. What? How can you kick like that? And you've never played a goal? I says, I played Gaelic football since I'm 8.
Yeah.
This is like 300,000 kids can do this way better than me. That was a penny drop moment for me. Like, is that there's so much opportunities for us to have unique skill sets from these sports that can help us in soccer, help us become better Gaelic footballers, rugby players, hurlers. Yeah. And I think Ireland, we should be doing our best to create these opportunities.
Good point. And even the fact that you mentioned earlier that, in AIK, in your own club, you've got the kids have access to 11 sports. Like that in itself has to be beneficial, you know?
If the kids want that, they're offered the opportunities to take part. And if a child misses training because he's playing in the ice hockey or the basketball, we mark them present.
Brilliant. I like that. I just want to ask you about your club. Now, you've touched on it a little earlier on, Mark, but I love the club's motto. And it's essentially, in terms of your player development, for as many as possible, for as long as possible, to try and be as good as possible.
Yeah.
It's a really nice way of framing it.
Yeah. Well, that's actually, I think, basically a motto that is used throughout Swedish football. I wouldn't say it's not just our club. And as many as possible is as long as possible in as good environment as possible or as good as possible.
Yeah.
That's really like when you think about it, it's captured in the three strategic goals of the club: well-being, follow United Nations rights of children, and more players playing under 16, under 17, under 19, and in our senior teams, as many as possible, as long as possible, as good as possible. And well-being is the starting point.
Yeah.
Well-being of children is so important here. I mean,
good to hear because we often say talk is cheap, and I hear loads of people who would try and articulate a kind of philosophy, or a club might try and tell you their vision or mission, but you don't see it transferred into then the plans around how they actually deliver on that.
Okay.
So the fact that ties in with the motto, your well-being approach and the human rights are the UN and of Nations for Children. That's amazing.
What's powerful is, so if we have, say, some kids that want to come to the club, or a coach comes in and has an idea of what they want to do. Well, how does this add to our culture and help develop well-being?
Right.
That's a good starting point for any conversation.
I watched, and it's something we will talk about on the pod in future episodes, but I watched that Football's Darkest Secret documentary there recently. And my God, children's well-being was the furthest thing from those people's minds back then. And I know it was a long time ago, but it was horrendous to see that. So it's great to see it been at the forefront of how we should develop our children now.
I saw that. Those are some seriously brave people that came forward.
Oh, man. Yeah. It's something we do want to chat about in the pod. It's nearly an episode in itself. But I mean, just to watch it and to see how those kids were treated and abused, people abusing their power, shocking.
There's an underlying problem with what I see the FA statement. And that is, it's 2021 and they're talking about bringing in safeguarding strategies for children. It's 2021.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, you know, right. Again, the market has been driving this.
Yeah, but yeah. I think it's really interesting. Like, I mean, in that kind of motto for player development, it's the first time, and maybe I'm just naive, it's the first time I ever heard of anybody referencing the UL goals for wellbeing for kids.
You know, Nation Convention Rights Children. Yeah, I mean,
I haven't heard of that anywhere else. And you kind of then ask the question, well, why wouldn't you be doing that? Why
wouldn't that underpin? It's a law, but also it's not something that you can just force on. It's something you live, evolve, and develop together with other people. It's not something you just have as rules. Here we are, and we say we use it. This is something you constantly work with every day. And you use it in your training, in your practice, in your daily interactions with people. It's something that lives.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Yeah. It's incredibly powerful. Another question I have for you, Mark, is you referenced your dad, Jerry, as being a great coach and a good coach for you when you were growing up. What does good look like for you, or what made him a good coach for you?
I know I mentioned that in the Examiner article, and my dad, like, he's 81 now, and he's still a better welder than me. He was a welder, so I can't fix a plug or change a light bulb. This guy could build anything, you know? But what I felt was him, he understood that, you know, children need to feel good first. So any training we had, games, and I always remember he taught me a massive lesson when I was about 12. We were playing a game, it was only a friendly, it was about 5 minutes into the game. One of the opposing players goes to shoot, completely misses a ball, falls in his arse, and I start laughing. And he just takes me off. Yeah. He says, and that's it. And he says, and then at halftime he says, go over and apologize to them. Wow. So he apologized. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
Good man. He says, good. Very good. Mark, well done. You apologize. That's a grand. But you'll be playing the next game. Don't worry.
Yeah, yeah. So important. You
know, and that's not punishment. That was learning.
A little bit like Damien Hughes' story, Mark, about his dad teaching him a lesson. Yeah. In a boxing ring like that, he saw him behave in a particular way. So he taught him a little lesson in his own way. And then afterwards just put his arm around him and said, right, that the way I made you feel was the way you made that other kid feel.
Yeah,
so, you learned.
And I'll never forget that. But the thing is then, like, is that I still am in contact with lots of guys in the team. And they always ask how he is.
That's brilliant.
You know, and that's what it is. Like, how's your dad? You know, he's grand. Oh, jeez. It's great. Like, and nobody can, it's not that I remember him as being a coach that designed great environments. Nobody remembers that. But what I remember is how he made people feel.
Oh, that's brilliant. That's gold, that's what you just said there. And I think I say it all the time, it's about coaching the person. It's not the drill, not the technique, it's not the tactics. It's about coaching. Your job as a coach is develop and help develop better people. That's your job. End of.
Yeah, no, it's funny. I still, when I think back on all the coaches I've had in my days as a player, and I had lots of good ones and lots of bad ones, but the coach I remember the most fondly was my under-9 coach because of the way he made us feel. You know, he always made us have a laugh and looked after us. And I remember that, like, you know, 40 years later. It's mad, you know?
Yeah, and, look, and you wanted to go train and you wanted to take a ball. You wanted to do your best for him.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I still, when I meet the man, and he's still alive, thankfully, I still call him Mr. Kelly. I won't call him by his first name. You know, so when I meet him, it's just the thing I've just got used to. It's, hi, Mr. Kelly. And it's, you know, it's great, but it is so important that you do kind of remember.
It's a great thing is that from this, my dad's team, 5 players played League of Ireland.
Ah, fantastic.
Wow.
Yeah.
And do you know what? He can't, I said it to him and he goes, is that right? She's that's right. Yeah, she's they were a good. It was good fun with them, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
No, but it was. If I was saying if my dad was a coach now, he'd be on Twitter telling everyone about it.
He'd have a book. He'd have a download of a book.
Oh, he'd have a book and he'd have some curriculum and he'd, he'd do lectures
at all these events.
He'd be on Twitter and anytime one of them scored a goal, he'd be on Twitter and say, dare I tell him how to do that?
I told him that, yeah. Listen, no, Mark.
He'd post a picture from his under-9 scoring a goal similar. That's what he did.
Listen, I read that question. If we restarted youth sport from zero and rebuilt it based on children's emotional and physical needs, you know, would it look like it does today? And I was intrigued to hear you say that no one has ever answered yes. So yeah, I'd love if you just talk to us a little bit more about that, please.
Like the thing is, I kind of touched on it earlier. about these the whole system. I mean, the model that we use for youth child sports is actually the professional model. It's competition. Think of it, you know, that we have kids like seven playing in full football strips. You know, there's nothing wrong with that now, first of all, but you have to think of it. Is it, you know, like we've actually asked ourselves this question. Is it okay that our eight-year-olds have the same strip exactly as the senior team? You know, what message are we sending with this? Now, I'm not saying it's wrong, but we need to think about these things because it's all we're doing is mirroring the professional sport. So, and then the structures. At the time, we used to have, like, you have cup competitions for eight-year-olds or something, you know, trophies and knockouts. The whole thing is, and we're teaching children to compete when we should be teaching them to collaborate. So then on top of that, when you have these academies where they have early selection, you're told if you're not good enough at the end of the year, you're dropped. So kids are learning to compete with each other in the same team. Instead of, and what do they have to do when they play in senior football? They must collaborate. But we're teaching them all the way to compete with each other. And that's looked as great. Oh, you know, they want to win, they're competing with each other. But they're not collaborating, they're not helping each other be better. So we need, like, so I've asked this question, how it's structured, all the things around it, you know, would it look like it does, would it, if we started in children's needs and emotional and physical needs, would it look like it does today? You know, would we be using products, elite with 8 and 9 and 10 year olds? So it's kind of all connected to what I've said earlier.
Yeah.
And I've lectured in North America, I've lectured in Europe, and even I asked this in universities. I've done lectures to master students and degree students. And I asked this question. Nobody's ever said yes, ever, anywhere. I asked this, I opened up with that question at the World Ice Hockey Conference. There was NHL coaches there. It was awkward silence.
Wow.
Like in Canada, there are eight-year-olds going to games playing ice hockey dressed in suits.
Mad.
Serious. They were telling me this. Suits.
Absolutely so mad.
This is what we're talking about. Like, what? So that's what I'm touching with that question.
It's a brilliant question. And it really deserves more time than we're giving it here to dig into.
No, the thing is, I'm not saying a kid shouldn't wear the same strip as their first team. I'm just saying, we need to discuss this. Like, well, what does this actually mean to have all these badges? And there's a problem, too, is that when you have these particular early academies selection, you have a badge that defines the child. A child's identity is attached to that. And that's a ticking psychological time bomb.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so these are things we need to discuss, these things, because there's probably no perfect answer at all. There isn't. But these discussions need to be had, I think.
Well, one Brilliant. Of the most dangerous sentences in the English language is we've always done it this way.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's fascinating. My wife is an early child educator, and she talks an awful lot about democracy in early childhood education and how it should be just all about play up to a particular age. But yet we're trying to model 2 and 3 year olds to be primary school kids to get them ready. And she's going, no, just let them play. So she talks a lot about identity and how you just need to let kids be kids and stop the adult influence. So there's lots of correlation in terms of how we're educating our kids, both in schools or early school settings or sport. Or it's a really, really interesting topic. So, no, I tell you, I'd love to chat some more about that. But I think we'll take you a little bit away for something a little bit more lighthearted now.
Yeah, I'm intrigued. I'm absolutely intrigued by this. So Gav reliably informs me that you've played in Sweden at a musical festival in front of 10,000 people with Morten Hackett from AHA.
That was in Norway.
Was it Norway? Right.
It was 9.
Norway, Sweden. The fact that you
9.
Played, yeah, like,
I, but so, this is you, actually D Morten Hackett from D AHA.
Okay, I'll start from, this is, oh God. No. All right, anyway, okay. It's like, okay, about 2 years ago, just before Christmas, I got a call from a guy in Norway, an email, and he said, hey, I'm writing Morten Harkett's autobiography. I tell you, this is true. And he spoke about the time we worked together and the songs and stuff. He says, can I interview you? So I'm actually in 3 pages in the autobiography.
Wow, it's only a Cork man could do that.
I know. So I photos everything. There's photos and all in the autobiography. I'll have two of them. I'm drinking cans.
Lovely. Nice.
I'll find him and I'll say, Devante, I'm actually drinking cans of beer and he's playing guitar. So we did some work and we wrote some songs, and we had about 6 or 7 tracks, and he wasn't with a ha at the time. And I was in Norway. I actually stayed in his place in Norway a few times. We worked in a little studio and he was over here.
Brilliant.
And then his manager, what was his name? Terry Slater. Terry Slater signed the Sex Pistols and Blondie. Wow. And started Rock in Rio.
Yeah.
Wow. He was managing your man, the guitarist in Queen as well. So he was over here having dinner with us, and we were going to sign to a label, and then some lawyers got involved because there was a thing, aha, we're getting back together, and then there was lawyers, and then there was all his contracts. So basically, lads, if I had signed that deal and made all that money, I wouldn't be wasting my time with you. Oh, here I am. And that was 1998. But one of the things he asked me, would I come over and perform a track live with him at a concert? And I did.
Fantastic. Honestly say that nobody on the podcast so far has played with Morten Harkett from AHA. That's a first.
Yeah, I think you've probably topped that one now. I'll give you that. Like, it's not that, there's not much compared to that now.
I have the evidence to prove that. It's in the book. It's so funny.
It's a typical Irishman that would just... random fact like that would just appear.
It's brilliant.
It doesn't happen to anybody else except
When I actually was reading it, when I was researching a little bit about you, I was saying, I had to ask him this because I don't know whether this is a piss take or whether this is actually true. Oh, but listen, I tell you, we're coming towards the end of our chat, and it's been amazing chatting to you, right? But I'm interested. You've done a huge amount of research, and you clearly have a lot of good ideas about stuff, which I'm loving. But tell me, so we're always talking about being idea thieves and nicking stuff off people to be better coaches. So what's the last good idea that you nicked?
Probably a baseline.
Nice. Off Morten Harkett. my own two sons are musicians. They're going to love this when I tell them about this.
Class. Last question for the night. And I have to ask you to do me a favor as well. So I'm a diehard Celtic fan, as Gav knows. But one of my favourite modern Celtic players, Mikael Lustig, is at IAK.
So I want that's right. Yeah,
If you ever get a chance to see Mikael Lustig, tell him that Mark and Dylan from Dublin absolutely love him, and tell him to say hello. We wish he was back at Celtic. But my last question for you: do you have a favourite sporting memory?
I'll give you. I have two, and I'm going to give them. They're off the wall. So
that doesn't surprise me.
So. I'm 18 years of age. I'm doing my Leaving Cert and I'm playing for UCD. So I'm travelling up to Cork, from Cork to Dublin at weekends, and I'm playing with UCD. And we're playing Home Farm, and Home Farm are managed by Ray Tracy. I fall asleep on the train going up and I wake up and my back is in a mess. So it was Tony O'Neill. Remember him?
Dr. Tony O'Neill. He was the doc at the time.
So I am absolutely in business. He goes, I had a bit of deep heat there. And we'll say, so I'm playing like, and I'm struggling, I'm having a mare and I'm struggling. And it comes to half, it's about a minute to half time, we get a corner and I'm centre midfield and I'm going, she said, I'm not going up for that at all. So I'm standing about 10 metres outside the box and I'm like hands on my knees, my back killing me. Next thing, the ball comes across, it's volleyed out, you know, the ball is in the air. And I'm like, oh shit. And they're expecting me to take it down and I just absolutely... damn, fact that I smash it. I just hit it. And it goes straight into the postage stamp, into the goal.
Oh wow, Lord.
I collapsed on the ground and I couldn't even move. And then, that was an amazing memory. And all I hear is Ray Tracy and the rest of them shouting abuse. Who is marking him? And I can't even move.
That's class.
And the other one then is from I think it's 2001. I've a friend of mine who passed away there from COVID, who lived in Brazil. He passed away recently. We were in college together in Cork, Paul Soden. The guy basically pushed me over the finishing line for my exams with coffee. And I was over visiting him, and he built a farm, started working and restoring Amazon rainforests. And he had an apartment in Rio. This is one night he says to me, he says, do you want to come for a game of seven-a-side there? I have a couple of friends playing seven-a-side. So I'm going, yeah, sure. So I head down anyway. I walk down and I look around and go, what are these guys? Next thing is Romario. So I'm playing seven-a-side Romario.
Oh, Lord.
And I'm going, how the hell did this happen? he's a bit better than me now, okay? But I actually scored a goal and I mishit a ball, completely mishit it. And it went into the net and he actually applauded me and I wanted, I wanted to collapse. But then I didn't find out until after is that a lot of the guys in their 50s were actually ex-Brazilian internationals and some of the 18 and 90-year-olds. I was like, but he was like the funniest guy out there, like, you know, the and welcoming and everything. So they're the two big memories.
I thought you couldn't beat the Morton Harkett story. I think you just did.
I've got to be honest, Mark.
It's hilarious.
I've got to put this out here. I think you could be the most interesting guest we've had yet. I'm just going to, just judging by the stories there, I think you could be up there with probably the most interesting set of stories.
Oh, fantastic. It has been amazing chatting to you, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it. But I will leave you with one final question. And every time we get a guest on, we ask them to name their dream fantasy five-a-side team. You're the gaffer, so whoever you want is on the team. So who makes your dream team?
Well, I'm playing anyway, so so it's just basically give me the ball and spread out. I would say Romario because I played him. So I'm thinking that. And actually,
as your strike partner.
As a kid, my father was a welder and he used to work for, I think it was Anko at the time, or Manpower. And one of his students was Dave Barry.
Oh, Davey Barry, what a player.
So,
yeah.
He was playing in Tramore Athletic under 18s or the minor team. And when they were training, sometimes I used to be allowed in, join in the five aside at the end. I was a few years younger. So brilliant. I put Dave Barry in there as well. And I put another guy, Ger Cunningham. Because Ger Cunningham,
the famous goalkeeper.
Yeah. One of the best soccer goalkeeper I ever saw.
Oh, I never knew he played soccer.
Yeah, he's won the FAI Youth Cup with Tramore Athletic. They beat Home Farm. They beat Home Farm A in the semi-final, and they beat Home Farm B, who were A, as well, in the final. Yes. And I remember it because the Tramore deliberately turned up with all their boots in Dunstore's plastic bags just to give the impression that they didn't care.
Okay, well.
And it was that Kieran O'Regan who went, I was at the game, Kieran O'Regan who went to Brighton. Scored the winning goal. But Ger Cunningham was immense. And actually, I know Celtic wanted to sign him. They were desperate. But he stuck with the guys. Fair juice to him. And I might sound controversial, but I wonder if Cunningham had stayed with Paddy Bonner, what would I have said about Paddy Bonner? Because this was
absolutely, who knows?
I've never seen
Cunningham was an incredible hurling goalkeeper.
Yeah, incredible. Yeah.
And I remember he famously, every time he competed, I think he won the puck fodder for years.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. He was some soccer goalkeeper.
Jeez, I didn't know that. So give me that again. So far, you're in the team, right? I think that's a given.
Obviously,
you and Romario, you and your buddy Romario.
Ger Cunningham's my goalie.
Ger Cunningham, there's a good by goalie team flowing through goalie this. So you've one more spot.
Who am I going to give that to now?
Morton Harkett, I think.
Morton Harkett, yeah. We'll give it to Morton Harkett because I reckon we'll fill any stadium with him.
There you go. See, there you go.
Half-time entertainment as well.
Thinking of your marketing. That's not a bad side. So, Ger Cunningham, so in goal, and then the rest is just up front.
Joe Cunningham's fly goalie. He can do it. Dave Barry, Romario, myself, and Morton Harkett.
I never thought coming onto this podcast that I would hear Dave Barry and Romario mentioned in the same sentence. That is just fantastic.
But they're all people who played with.
Oh, there you go. Even better.
Many people can say that.
That's a criteria.
That is one of the greatest five-a-side teams I think I've ever heard in any context. No, so listen, Mark, as I said before, it has been an absolute pleasure chatting to you. I knew when you were coming on, the fact that you were from Cork, you'd be interesting. That was a given. You know what I mean? But I have to say, it's been great crack. And it only remains for us to thank you again, wish you all the best for the future. And we'd love to keep in touch with you and you know, follow your progress in terms of your research and stuff. I think what you're doing is absolutely tremendous. And we will follow it closely. But really, thank you so much. And
take care of
yourself. Absolutely brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much, Mark.
Thank you.
Just some coaching shout outs now. Just to name check, a few coaches have engaged with us on Twitter during the week. First up, the bearded coach at Peter Prickett on Twitter. Check him out. Peter's recently released a book on the principles of play. It's really well put together and well worth checking out. Shane at Fon Forest on Twitter, always a good supporter of the pod since day one. Cheers, mate. Appreciate the support. And finally, Rob Porter at RJP Coach, a future guest on the pod, hopefully. Just give Rob a follow. Really decent guy and always share some good stuff. Cheers, lads. And also to everyone who regularly or not regularly engages with on socials. We really do appreciate it. So moving on to the coach's war chest. In the war chest every week, we try and recommend a variety of things for coaches to check out just to aid your own personal development. So, Mark, what can you recommend for us this week?
I just have three things for us this week. One is actually a Twitter and a website that I follow now. It's called Players Tribune. It's got a lot of really good connections of stories from all various different parts of the sporting world, both relevant to what's happening in sport and some of the issues of it. And I find it's actually really good for picking up kind of just some information about what else is happening in other sports and just some really good news bits. And so I follow them on Twitter now, and I've logged onto their website and read some of the articles, and it's really, very interesting. Another one is a book, Living on the Volcano. I think it's a couple of years old at this age. It's The Secrets of Surviving as a Football Manager by Michael Calvin. There's some good spin in Arsene Wenger in it. And it's really interesting. Arsene Wenger came up with the quote that management is like living on a volcano. You never know when it's going to erupt. So that was quite good. And another one, which is a really interesting, is the recent Alex Ferguson film that came out, which is very, very good. Not because of just a footballer, because it's a real insight into him as an individual and his challenges growing up and his journey, and some very interesting stories about his time even at Rangers when he was a player, and his wife, Cathy, who is Catholic, and how he said it to Rangers, and how he's been told to keep it quiet and everything else. So some very interesting behind the scenes. It's all off the basis of the back of his recent health scares and when he was in hospital very seriously sick. And it's kind of a reflection on his life by him. So it's very, very interesting.
Brilliant. What's that called? Is it a movie or a documentary?
Yeah, it's a movie. It's a documentary. I can't remember if it's Netflix or Amazon or what's on, but if you just put in Alex Ferguson,
cool.
It's very, very good.
Yeah, nice one. I'll check it out. All right, mate. Cheers. Brilliant. Give us the name of that first one again. Was it Players Tribune?
Players Tribune, yeah. Very, very interesting. Like, I mean, it's even like for a story. There's a lot of American stories around some of the sports in America, but I found it really, really interesting for some of the social aspects and some of the, so there was really good articles on the tennis players there that, and what's going on there, some of the struggles around mental health and mental challenges that some of the guys and how they've been tackling that in American football and basketball, and a lot of the social part of football, of sport that we don't always hear about. So very interesting, really good. It's like a daily newspaper as such.
Excellent.
With some really good, and some good articles down around. Even I picked up stuff about the Gareth Southgate article that we spoke about at the start of the show and all of that. So very interesting.
Fantastic. Great stuff, mate, as always. I'll check them out. Cheers. That's it, folks. The end of the sixth episode of season two. We're edging ever closer to the summer barbecue. My thanks, as always, to the lads, Mark, Paul, Willie and Mick, for sharing their vast knowledge and experience. Really is appreciated, lads, and always good to chat. Cheers also to Mark O'Sullivan for joining us tonight all the way from Sweden, sharing his own brilliant knowledge and funny stories and experience with us. Continued success, mate. We'll keep in touch. Thanks as ever to new friends of the show, Player Stat Data, for sponsoring season two, to Colin and his team. It really is appreciated, boys. Finally, thanks as ever to all of the brilliant coaches out there for your continued dedication to your players. It's been absolutely brilliant over the past few weeks just getting back training and coaching. And in the next few weeks, obviously, games are going to start back, which is just fantastic. Nothing beats it. So please give the pod a follow and help us to spread the word. Don't forget to leave us comments so we can keep improving how we help you on your coaching journey. As always, get in touch with us at Coaching Badges on Twitter. Finally, as Euro 2020, which sounds mad, kicks off, enjoy the Euros over the next few weeks. Really looking forward to seeing what that throws up. And remember, when it comes to coaching, there's no right or wrong way, but there's always a better way.